It's now about 7 minutes after 2 p.m. We're joined by the chair of the Senate Resources. No, the chair's not here. By Senator Lehman and Senator Lida Green. So we have two Greens here. Mm-hmm. That balances out nicely. And
the beauty and the beast. Just
trust us, Mr. Chairman. We'll take care of things.
Right.
Chairman, I don't think they're very green.
I don't. Well, I doubt that too. But as well as some of the members that were here this morning, what we're going to do now is to have an overview, a timber industry briefing. Truly appreciate all of the folks that are in town here to give us some ideas what's going on in the timber industry and let us know what we can do to assist and what we consider to be a very important element of our economy. And so we'd start right out with Jack Phelps. Jack, if you'd come up to the table and introduce us, if you would, please, to the Resource Development and Interior.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, it's Jack Phelps, Alaska Forest Association Executive Director. And I'm kind of wearing two hats this morning. Our interior member wasn't able to be here, so I'm going to give you kind of an overview of the association and of our issues and then talk to you a few minutes about interior issues. The Alaska Forest Association is the statewide Alaska timber industry trade group, and as such, it represents about 300 member companies doing business in the timber industry in Alaska. We have three divisions in the association. One is the part that you folks see the most of, and that's the government affairs and public relations side of our operation. But we also operate what's called the Tongass Timber Trust, which is a group health insurance plan for our members and their employees. And you're going to hear a little bit more about that from Mr. Gildersleeve. And then we also operate the Alaska Loggers Association Retirement Trust, which is a pension program for our members and their employees. These are all run out of our office in Ketchikan. With respect to state timber issues, the association has identified a couple of key priorities that I would like to mention here in the next couple of minutes. First of all, our mission statement says that the Alaska Forest Association works to maintain a viable forest products industry as an important part of Alaska's economy. So that's our key mission statement. And in respect to that, there are two issues on the state level that are of very, very immediate importance to us. First of those is to maintain the state's timber sale program. A number of our members depend directly on purchase of state timber from the state forested lands. There are mills in South Central and in the interior that depend on that timber. And you'll hear particularly today from the largest purchaser of timber on the Kenai Peninsula, Circle D.E. Pacific, and some of the attempts that the industry there is making to help address that problem. And I think it's important in that regard to notice that timber harvest, particularly because of its ability to provide money to the state for reforestation, is a key element in addressing the beetle epidemic in South Central Alaska. The second of our key priorities on state issues this year is to maintain the integrity of the Forest Practices Act implementation with DNR as the lead agency. We think that it's especially important that the committee be aware of the need to keep the Alaska Department of Fish and Game in that process to make sure that they uphold their statutory and regulatory responsibilities and their commitment to provide adequate field presence in Forest Practices Act issues. We hear a lot about the lack of money. We think maybe there's an allocation problem that ought to be looked at. We think it's very, very important for them to maintain their statutory responsibility and field presence in implementing what we consider to be a very good act in terms of its balance. AFA is doing its part with respect to forest practices. AFA and member companies have invested over the last 4 to 5 years an average of $120,000 into scientific stream monitoring studies. We anticipate doing that again in this year, and in fact anticipate an increased level of commitment in terms of monetary commitment to that those studies. We believe that a full participation of the agencies in the fisheries forestry working group on cooperative forestry research is essential to make the Forest Practices Act issues work. The industry is not afraid of the facts, scientific facts, with respect to our timber harvest activities and its effect on other uses of the forest. We have demonstrated our commitment to that by commitments of time and commitments of money. We believe that it's crucial that the agencies show a greater commitment to cooperation on these issues. And it may be even that the legislature may have to act in terms of making the Cooperative Working Group on Forestry Fishery Research a more official body. And that may be something we may be discussing with you in the future. I'm going to take that hat off now and talk to you about interior issues for just a moment. There are no large manufacturers operating in Alaska's interior. By that, I mean operations processing more than 10 million board feet a year. However, there is a capacity for growth. There's a capacity for expanded harvest and utilization of our timber resources in the interior. And there is interest in expanding that. Northland Wood Products currently is the largest mill operating in the interior. They process about 3 million board feet a year. And they very recently, and we're pretty excited about this, they recently joined with a major West Coast grading bureau and are now providing structural graded lumber into the interior market. There, the harvest of white spruce in the interior, which is the principal commercial species, currently averages about 10 to 15 million board feet. Two-thirds of that is on state land. The other third is on private lands, primarily Native Corporation lands. The birch, or the hardwood resources, and in the packet that you handed out is an article I recently wrote for Society of American Foresters regarding Alaska's untapped hardwood resources. The state has an allowable cut of 60 million feet in the interior. We're currently harvesting less than a million. We are actively exploring options for companies to come in and utilize that. You've heard about the LC project. Despite what you might read in the paper, that project is not dead. However, it does depend upon the state's willingness to increase its harvest of spruce, because their mix looked like they need about 60% spruce and about 40% birch. But here's an opportunity to use the birch, and I think we should be doing what we can to make that happen. That's about all the brief comments that I wanted to take time to make. There is one further matter before I leave, and that is to say that one person we'd like to have you hear from is Megan Smith from the National Biofuels Institute. They have what may be a very viable proposal for Alaska. Unfortunately, she couldn't be here today, but she will be in town on Thursday. So if it was the pleasure of the committee or the pleasure of the chairman, perhaps you could hold a piece of this today's hearing over to Thursday so that you could hear from her. Just a suggestion and an opportunity for you to hear from her.
Thank you, Jack. We'll do that, as a matter of fact, since she's going to be in town. And what little I understand is that she's looking at fuel from pulp. Is that correct?
Basically, they can convert wood waste to ethanol. And as you may know, Alaska has an 8.5 cent a gallon tax incentive to use ethanol as an additive to reduce air emissions. And currently, that the ethanol we're using in Alaska is produced in Ohio and comes across the country by rail and up on a barge. If we could produce it here in Alaska, it's a major advantage to us.
And if you could make certain that we're put in touch with her so that we can make arrangements for her appearance.
Absolutely.
That'd be a good spot to do it. So, are there any questions? Yes, Representative Green.
Mr. Chairman, this is a question to you. I'm not sure what the agenda you have today and Thursday. Will you be taking any testimony from any of the agencies, or will this all be private?
This, what we intended to do here is to hold this joint oversight or briefing. So we do not intend to. What we want to do is learn at this stage, and then hopefully we'll identify if there are any pertinent legislation or others. Invite these folks back, and we'll have the give and take at that time.
With your indulgence,
yes,
sir, then I might have a question for you, Jack. Senator Lehman and I co-chaired a hearing last fall in which there were statements made by the then forester and the Department of Fish and Game that made me feel that there was a strong resentment to logging. And even when there was a buffer left, that there was a potential adverse effect to the environment of the habitat. And I was concerned when I heard you say earlier in your testimony today that you would welcome fish and game. Would there be, in your feeling, any merit to saying, yes, we would like to have fish and game input, but perhaps there should be more fact and less bias?
Representative Green, through the chair. Yeah, that was exactly the point that I was trying to make. I think that the involvement of Fish and Game with respect to their statutory authority under the Forest Practices Act, or responsibilities, I should say, statutory responsibilities, and also their participation in the Cooperative Working Group on Forestry Fisheries Research, which is a broad-based group. It includes industry, it includes agencies, both federal and state, includes fishing interests and so forth, which is designed to look at, examine, and further research into these areas. As I said, the industry is not afraid of the science. And we think science should take first place over emotion in terms of whether, what we do on our public lands.
Thank you.
Thank you, and thank you, Mr. Phillips.
Thank you.
We'd like to invite Mr. Gildersleeve. Table, please. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman.
To give us your name and.
My name is Keaton Gildersleeve. I'm president of the Alaska Forest Association, and I am also the president of Gildersleeve Logging. I came to Alaska in 1953. My dad came up and went to work in the woods at that time for Ketchikan spruce mills. My family has logged in Alaska continuously since that time, and my wife and I purchased the operations in 1980. We normally log in the range of 30 to 50 million board feet per year and build the attendant 10 to 20 miles of road that would require. Last year, our company's sales and production were in the upper end of that range. We are pleased that we have never had a violation of the Alaska Forest Practices Act in that time. We have always been contract loggers. We have logged for Native corporations, a variety of Native corporations, starting in 1982, and logged continuously on long term until mid-1993 on the long term sale. Our operation involves the complete job from the stump to completed raft. My wife is the owner of a tugboat and barge company that we do ship tending, log towing, charter and support work for remote sites, other loggers such as ourselves, and we do some subcontracting for specialty jobs such as helicopter logging and occasionally drilling and blasting of a nature that's more technical than our usual operation. We have run as many as three different separate operations, two of which are exclusively family-oriented, and one which typically goes ahead of our operations, you know, and preparing a site when we're going there. We hire about 125 people. That would include our subcontractors. Our operations have run between 8 to 10 months out of the year. Our shops and so on run continuously. This year we've been building road all through the winter because we had a mild winter. My wife and I take great pride in the employment opportunities that we can provide for people that are not afraid to work. Many of our employees are second generation, and some are third generation to work for either my father or myself. We're extremely proud of the quality and level of education that our children at our schools have attained. We have had graduates from University of Alaska, private and public colleges in the Northwest, and two graduates of our high schools that have graduated from the military academies. We operate our camps on a family-oriented basis. We have all of the functions out there that you would normally associate with a town, including salmon derbies and other social functions. Our children are very industrious and raise money. They travel quite a lot and raise their own. Because our operation is unique in that it is on a floating logging camp, all the children are required to wear life jackets until they can demonstrate they can swim. Gildersleeve Logging has used all the technologies from A-frame logging, which was directly into the water, to the balloon logging and helicopter logging. Our first major job was in the Thorn River drainage when the Forest Practices Act was somewhat different, and logs were logged directly into Thorn Bay, the Thorn River. We have had our operations in approximately 24 different sites. These areas now have extensive merchantable second growth timber, and the salmon streams in these areas happen to be among the most productive on Prince of Wales. From a silviculture point of view, we feel that these stands are superior to the original harvest. I'll tell you a little bit about the Alaska Forest Association to add to what Jack does. We also have a operation that we spun off that is the Alaska Timber Insurance Exchange, which provides workers' compensation for qualifying members. These programs, all of our programs, the retirement, our health benefit programs, and our insurance programs will have to be examined for long-term viability in light of the pending loss of up to one-third of our beneficiaries. The health insurance program will be the first that we anticipate to have problems because of the implications of the COBRA Act. Our families that live in floating logging camps and in temporary land-based camps that disappear when a job is done are Alaskans. As I said, we have many second generation and some third generations now. I'm very pleased that my daughter, who is going to be a fourth generation, when she wrote her thesis on what she wanted to be, she said she was going to be the boss of the logging camp. So we plan to be here a long time. The state and federal programs that I have observed that are targeting the troubled areas, I think that some consideration needs to be made for people that are displaced, that do not live in established municipalities or towns. Thank you for inviting me here today. I'm not a public speaker, but I can assure you that I would like to be a source of information, a help to you as we approach what is going to be difficult times. We all recognize that. And I'd be happy to answer questions now or at the end of the briefing, and I'll leave my address and telephone number for those of you that would like to contact me either personally or in my capacity as AFA president. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gildersleeve. I have one first, and then I'll turn over to Mr. Barnes. When was the last time that the groups that were involved in crafting the Forest Practices Act, do they get together from time to time? Have you met with, for example, the fisheries side of the habitat and the streams and things like that? Has there been that kind of a collection in recent years?
Not formally, no.
You think that would be a good thing to do, to maybe bring back together periodically just to make certain that everybody is still singing out of the same hymnal and understanding what's going on in the
Speaking for the Alaska Forest Association, we feel that it's a good act, and we feel that the facts, when viewed objectively by anyone, will bear scrutiny. So we would certainly welcome that opportunity, I believe.
Representative Barnes?
Mr. Chairman, I don't have a question, but I do have a comment. If memory serves me correctly, Mr. Gildersleeve's father was head of the Loggers Association in the early 70s. I met your father at that time.
That is correct, ma'am.
So I just wanted to let you know that.
Other questions of Mr. Gildersleeve? Anyone from the committee? Representative Woody?
Yeah. Keaton, since the closure of the Sitka Pulp Mill and Wrangell Mill, Now we're talking about the closure of Ketchikan Pulp Company. And I guess reading the Ketchikan Daily News, there's two mills that are going to be down because of lack of wood. How much was your company cutting prior to this, and what are they producing today?
The highest volumes that we've ever cut were in the neighborhood of 55 million feet.
And that's per year?
Yes. Either from the long-term sales or from a variety of private landowners.
And what are you cutting today? Are you still in that range yet?
No. No, we anticipate that this year we'll be logging in the neighborhood of 25 to 30.
And that, how much equipment do you have at laying idle?
Dollars?
Quite a bit.
Tons?
Yes.
Quite a bit.
Yes, we have.
How many sides did you have at first one?
Nine.
You only...
Nine complete logging sides. For those of you who are not completely familiar with that term, a logging side would, and Hi-Lead would typically be the tower, the log loader, the trucks that support that, and that's a side, and that employs roughly 10 persons, not including your road building functions or any of the support operations, shop, camps, and so on.
Representative Green?
If I could follow up on Representative Williams' question, you indicated almost a 50% drop from where you were at one time to where you are now. Are all nine of those camps still working, or have you had to cut out some of those camps?
No, we will be working at that percentage of our capacity.
But they'll all be working. They'll just be working shorter hours, or
there will be less people. We'll be down from, say, 125 last year to around 85.
Okay, so there's a job loss, significant job loss.
Very.
Thank you,
Massey.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm not very familiar with all this timber issues. I'm new on the Resource Committee, but I'd like to ask you a question about when you set up your sites and you move on. Do you have a permit system that you have to go through each time you open up a new area to log in, or does your permits carry you over for every site that you have?
No. Each place has site-specific permitting, and then our actual floating camp has generic permits that go with it, and then you have it. We have a full-time person that does nothing but tend to permits, and we also the landowners themselves have staff that take care of the notifications and so on that are required for the logging operations.
That's in the mask.
Mr. Chairman. Do you find that the permit system is onerous with the state or the federal government, or do you go smoothly through the process, or what is your biggest problem that you face as far as obtaining permits?
The biggest problem that we face right now is the timing. The full review, the coastal management review process, can take as long as a year, and for companies that are trying to respond to a market and have holdings in different sort of areas, unless they are fortunate enough to have them all permitted, then they're not really able to send us into the areas that will meet the markets that they need at that time. No, the permits are very onerous and very cumbersome.
Representative Massey?
Follow up again on that point too. Is it pretty costly for you to go through the permit process? Are you able to break even with that side, or do you find
No, that's a dead loss. it's right out the window. We have a, we hire a professional engineer, you know, he's paid accordingly, and by, so we figure that it costs us approximately $100,000 a year to meet our permit requirements.
Yes, Representative Masick.
And again, what area do
you're
feel?
You're on a roll. Keep going.
thank you, Mr. Chair. What area do you feel the state should look at as far as, you know, easing back on the requirements for these permits, but still doing it in a safe and environmental manner?
That's a good question. The problem is that in an operation like ours, you're dealing with the you're dealing with the tidelands, so you'll have the Army Corps of Engineers. Then from the mean low tide to mean high tide, you're maybe dealing with state lands or any other resources, streams, etc. that are under state jurisdiction, and then the restrictions that apply to the private or whomever's ownership. So, and the Coastal Zone Management Review process basically makes you go through the same hoops with each agency. So there could be a lot of streamlining in that area, in my opinion, if they just prioritize them. You know, to the extent of saying, you know, how many jobs write on this? You know, and draw a circle around it. You know, does that mean you should put it on your desk on Friday? Or should you, you know, wait till Monday? And, no, that's the biggest issue. And then, of course, in remote site, you have the permitting requirements with fuel transfers, which are, and spill prevention measures and so on, which are the, you know, come under the Coast Guard jurisdictions. And I understand that we can't really do very much about the federal end of it, but there's certainly a lot of things that could be done to make the process more workable at the state level. I'd be happy to talk to you anytime about it or bring my engineer up here and show you how the process works. I think that if you were shown how it works, I think that you would, it would be vastly superior than me criticizing the process from an admittedly biased point of view.
Mr. Gildersleeve, we will have a hearing on this Saturday. There is a bill that's been introduced to essentially opt out of the Coastal Zone Management program altogether. And we've already had one hearing on it, I believe, with pretty much of an oversight type of thing to get a couple of grips with just, you know, how extensive and what's happening there. You could help us, I believe, if we could get any input from you, if not by Saturday at any time, as to just what the responsibility and requirements are of working through that whole process and any recommended suggestions. Now, I don't know, you know, just how the final action of the legislature will be as far as what we deal with that bill, but we do want to understand it, and we want to make certain that it works, not only protect the environment and, you know, the coastal plan that we all have, but also that it works for companies like your own.
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to participate in that project. More likely, I would actually send somebody that's doing it, you know, the engineer himself that knows the technical languages and can more easily point out where the hang-ups are.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, sir. Next, Harold Champion. Good afternoon, Harold. Nice to have you before us here, sir.
Thank you, Representative Hudson. Proud that you're my representative from the 4th District in Juneau. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Errol Champion, and I'd spend a couple of moments. I've lived in Juneau for over 20 years. I've raised my family here, and I've been involved in the timber industry, mining, and other natural resource-type industries most of my life. I even took a run at elected office here locally and found out that there is a time limit certain on that, and went back into the private sector again. Presently, I'm the general manager for the aviation division for Silver Bay Logging. You see our large helicopters every time you come and leave the airport. We bought a fleet of Sikorskis in hopes that we were thinking what the Tongass would look like in the future when helicopter logging would be one of the predominant ways of harvesting wood. It does look like it's going to happen, but even so, I think some of the things I'll share with you today demonstrate the concern we have for the Tongass, and the fact that we own a lot of helicopters is no assurance that there's a life certain ahead in the timber industry. This last fall, Governor Knowles appointed 16 Alaskans to a timber task force, and your chairman has asked me to speak on that topic today about the Southeast Alaska Timber Task Force, which myself and Mr. John Sturgeon, who's also in the room, is one of the members of that force. I believe you have a handout of these foils, but for those that don't have a foil, the governor challenged the committee with five statements. And the mission statement was he would ask us to restructure the industry for competitiveness in the 21st century. It is changing. We were hearing about the changes that are going on, but shortly after the naming of this committee came Ketchikan Pulp's announcement that they were closing. So I think no one anticipated the significance of the changes that could be forthcoming. The second challenge was to develop solutions to the timber supply program, and you're going to hear most of my talk today deals with the empty wood basket. We simply do not have a fiber supply. Our president, AFA, Mr. Gildersleeve, talked about the reduction and the difficulty of permitting what's happened to his business. It simply is that there's just not a timber supply out there, and I'll show you some graphs and charts that back that up. What our real challenge before us is that up to 50% of our harvest in the Tongass is pulpwood or of what they call utility-grade sort. And with the closure of the mill, we have no place to go with that wood. Leaves us a couple of choices. It either is left in the woods, or it affects their impacts of the cost of the sale, or we simply stockpile it and wait and hope that someday there's another opportunity. The third was to stabilize the remaining players in the industry. When I first came to move into Southeast 20 years ago, there were 45 operating logging camps. Today there are 12. Tell you what's happened, and it's the present rate of decline, and what happens with the Tongass, and what's proposed to happen with T-Lump continues in the vein that's being talked about out of Washington, D.C. There won't even be 12. Provide assistance to individuals and businesses in the Southeast region. That's a very admirable mission, and we're trying to figure out what type of assistance could happen. But it still boils back that we need a timber supply. Without a fiber supply, no one's going to invest in Southeast. Provide counsel to the governor regarding wood products processing proposals. We've heard a lot about value-added. Last year there was more talk about a value-added bill, but if you don't have anything to add value to, you can't work on that point until you've taken care of the fiber supply. So the governor asked us to do a business plan and submit it to him by the middle of March, and that's our target date, but I think we're going to slip a little bit. It's just taking more time, and 16 people can't always agree. Let me talk a little bit about what's happened so far to date. On this committee, there are 7 mayors, 6 members from industry, and 2 from other interest groups. The first 2 areas we covered was the current status of timber supply from the Forest Service, and then the timber inventory and supply from 3 state agencies. And I'll come back to that with some charts here to give you the numbers that were shared with us. The next meeting consisted of receiving a report from Alaska Forest Association. I don't believe that this report was given to all of you, but it's the 4 visions of the Tongass. And Jack Phelps here could provide any of you with a copy of it. Again, the industry took a long, hard look at what would the Tongass really look like with 4 harvest levels. A harvest level of 300 million board feet, a harvest level of 420 million board feet, then one at 100 and one at 200. And it was the consensus of everyone that if the harvest level fell below 300 million annual sales quantity, that the Tongass as we now know it and the infrastructure that's there won't survive. It'll have a completely different look. There will not be the infrastructure. And no matter how anyone wants to present another view of the Tongass, if it won't make it without a sales harvest or harvest level at that number. SEAC came in with their views of the Tongass, and I believe their volumes were in the 50, 100 million and 150. Out of this was a resolution that was brought forth by some of the mayors in early December, and that resolution is in your packets. It basically is in support of the TLUMP decision, which had been postponed and continues to be postponed. But the resolution was on record saying that the Tongass and the members of the governor's task force is on record in support of the $300 million. The last presentation we've had was from the Forest Product Science group out of Wisconsin. They have been into Southeast on one other occasion, and they're now proposing to come back again. They will be holding five workshops throughout communities in Southeast and trying to derive from members of the community what are alternate uses and what are other ideas that other folks have for this low-end utility-grade wood. They also are proposing to take 2,000 pieces of wood. Now, we haven't been able to determine how big is a piece, whether it's a full log or whether it's an 8-foot chunk, but they're going in back into their lab and they want to tell us what are some other uses of this wood that no longer will be consumed through the pulp mill. Could be finger joints, could be door sashes, could be a variety of things, glue lamb beams. But that work is going to be ongoing, and it's going to take a while. And so I want to be sure, Mr. Chairman, and members of the committee understand that that science lab work is not going to be a fix-all for what's needed in the Tongass in 1997, or maybe even 1998. Anyway, we are now writing our business plan, and hopefully that will be finished here by the end of March. The last four foils I have will review for you the status of our timber resources. I'll do the three in state first. This is what the DNR has told the task force, that between 96 and the year 2000, out of the Haynes Forest, there'll be a harvest of 34.6, out of the Ketchikan, 8.2, out of the Juneau area, 17.3, for a total of 60 million over that 5-year period.
That's state.
That's a state timber, DNR. Remember the vision that was held up by AFA said we need $300 million a year. The next major landholder in the state is a university, and their presentation to the task force said that in their 5-year plan, they're anticipating sales in Southeast of 18.2, the Gulf Coast, Yakutaga of 50 million, 4 million off of the Kenai, and 0 out of the Fairbanks Delta for 72 million over that 5-year period. And the last major landholder in the state with timber resources is the Mental Health. They have about 130,000 acres of commercial forest land, but their presentation in December indicated that they have no plans at this time to go forward with timber harvest. That does not mean someday they will be interested in it, but at this time there's nothing that we as an operator in industry could count on. But there is about 345 million board feet. I want to point up something ironic with both the university and the mental health lands is there is no requirement for in-state manufacturing. So both of these landholders here just simply go out and advertise to the highest bid. In fact, the university's got a sale going on up at Yakutaga now that the operators out of lower Columbia River area, Kelso or somewhere down in there, and all of the logs leave without barely an Alaskan hardly touching them. And unless something has changed, there's no reason to expect, and not to pick on mental health or university, that's their charge or their commission. So they're literally going to the highest bidder. So as you can see, the issue for the timber industry and for all of the operators is that the wood basket is empty, and that the control, I guess I, pardon me, Mr. Chairman, I forgot one more foil. This is the most critical one of all here, is our friends in the Forest Service. This is their independent sales program, and they presented this chart to us in October, and in December came back and amended it. But they have three areas that they will be selling out of, the Stikine. And immediately after they listed some sales, some of them were challenged and will be held up in court or through an appeal. So instead of the 55.6 that they thought would happen, there'll only be 18.6 that will be offered in 1997. The Chatham area has 30 million of its 51 for a reduction because of litigation. And the Ketchikan area so far has not seen any sales challenge. But we've had a 67 million board foot reduction off of the 163, so we're back down to 96 million is all that the independent program will be offered this year. And I might add that if you look, these sales range from 100,000 board feet to 22 million. So when you look across that range of sales, there's a high number that are 100,000, 200,000, 300,000, and those are almost economically prohibitive to bid on. You can't go in, get the permits, and get set up with sales of that size and that scope. So I apologize for not showing that immediately, but this is the most critical one of all, and this is where our major landholder and supplier of timber is, and you can see what's happening.
Is that for
Williams?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Is this just for 97, fiscal year 97?
Yes, it is, Representative Williams. The other thing that this chart illustrates is this is at least the fourth year in a row where the commitment in October was for a much higher number, and then through a variety of reasons it keeps getting reduced and reduced and reduced. So again, as an operator, if we were counting on 163 million in October, we're now down to 96 and the year is only half over. So it's pretty hard to fill the pipeline and have a really, you need a three-year supply so you can take care of the peaks and the valleys and not be oversizing your business or undersizing your business and trying to deal with what's happening. The federal administration is unfavorable to logging. I think that the fact that T-Lump has continued to be delayed, that decision on the Tongass was promised in September, and then it was going to be November. We had resolutions. The governor's on record demanding Secretary Glickman get a T-Lump decision out. It didn't happen in December. It didn't happen in January. We heard that it was going to happen Valentine's Day. It still hasn't happened. And in speaking with the Forest Service this morning, they think maybe sometime in March. Their record or the recommendation that went in was 297 million board feet. I think the number is probably somewhere around 200 million. That's only a personal guess. But T-Lump is not going to be a decision that will bode well for the timber industry in Southeast. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Mr. Champion. We get copies of, do we have those already?
Yes, you do.
We already have them. All right, good. We'll be very interested, I think, in communicating with you again as we go on down the pike here, try to figure out what, if anything, we can do. You know, we are the policy makers. We're dealing with private lands and federal lands and T-Lump and state lands and timber access, and everything I've heard for the last year or two here at any rate is that, you know, this is the critical element. Can you get trees in order to, you know, to justify the process and the operations? And we'll need to learn some more about this. Today we're just going to try to get a groundwork on just what's going on out there, and then hopefully we can get back together with folks like yourself and figure out what we might be able to do from the legislative perspective. Any other questions, Representative Green?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We have been told recently, well, actually for the last few years, that fishing prices are down. Now we're hearing that chips, which had a pretty good market last year, now that's down. Round logs are down. And until last year, oil prices were down. Do you see a stigma being attached to Alaska that is going to create a problem in the future if we're kind of bouncing around the bottom of the barrel right now, that I would think that people that would normally go into the logging profession might decide to go into something else. And sometime down the road, if we're able to, or we can get the federal government to help us to allow more harvesting, do you see two things? One, will we have the workforce? And B, will the prices worldwide ever allow us to get back in a competitive mode?
Representative Green, attitude and a positive environment there where the investor community could come forward and you had this wood supply where you weren't
you
could go forward, that I think the marketing would take care of itself. We'll have some up years and some down years, and we're prepared to deal with that issue. But when you simply don't know whether you've got enough wood to operate the balance of the season, so what what is left is simply a fractured, fragmented effort here that causes the infrastructure just to gradually erode away, and that's what's happening. You give us a wood supply, and the infrastructure will take care of itself. There's no doubt that the quality of the wood out of the Tongass would make a viable product.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Oh, Senator Green.
A couple of things. One of the things that I recalled in last year when we were hearing some legislation about harvesting, and was the response to million board feet. And I think it would be good to translate to something that most of us non-loggers could understand as to what would a typical southeast tree equate to, or how many trees or acres or whatever are we talking about? Because I don't think it's as large as most people would conjure up when you're talking about millions of board feet.
Well, the range is extensive, but I would say that probably the average harvest is about 35,000 board feet per acre. But you can find where the harvest and the yield is much higher. I'm hesitant to tell on the size of a tree, because you get a very large spruce or a very low-grade utility hemlock, and that could be as misleading. But I guess, would be a good rule of thumb.
And in your calculations, have you also calculated the what would be the available harvest on private and native lands?
I have that data, but not with me. But they've been averaging in the vicinity of 150 to 200 million board feet in the Gulf of Alaska, Prince William Sound, throughout southeast Alaska area has been the harvest off of private lands. Remember, there are operations on Montague Island and on Afognak, Icy Bay, which is outside of the Tongass.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Errol. Appreciate that input. Very good presentation.
Mr. Chairman?
Next, if we could get John Sturgeon here. Yes, Representative Williams.
Could I ask him some questions?
You may. We are going to lose at least several of our members here by 4, or I think even 3:30, so if we can kind of keep it rolling along. Go ahead, sir.
Okay. You talked about the sawmills, the amount of timber that is going to be sold after, let's say for this discussion, that we're talking about 300 million board feet. So the pulp mill isn't going to be there. And you mentioned something about cutting it and maybe pulling it up to the landings or stacking it or whatever. What has the Timber Task Force done, or what are their thoughts on the amount of pulpwood that's going to be left in the woods, and how much, and what's a shelf life?
Well, it's a most significant concern, because there's the cost of harvesting that wood, and I would go to your second part of your question first. The average is at least 35%, so for every million board feet, you're going to have 350,000 of it that's utility grade, utility sort, that's going to have to be stacked or decked right now. Some places it'll run as high as 50%, but I think conservatively you can say 35% of your sort. And there simply is no marketplace. The Tongass will not allow you to export a round log, so it's simply going to remain decked, and the useful life maybe 3 years at the outside, but probably nothing more than that. You're just at the mercy. You're either going to have to leave it lay in the woods, or deck it in hopes that there's some other viability comes in terms of a sawmill or some other breakdown operation that you can comply with the federal laws and get around the primary manufacturer requirement.
One more.
Yes,
the T-lump that we've been talking about now, the task force had passed a resolution in support of 300 million board feet, and you mentioned when it was going to be out, maybe in March sometime. How important that is? Could you go over it again, how important that is? Who's saying it's so important? You know, we've been living like this without a T-lump revision for how many years? Over 10 years, and we've been working on it for 10 years. So.
Well, Representative Williams, I think the issue that's so critical is the wood basket or the pipeline dried up. We had an inventory, and especially when the two pulp mills were operating, they had a significant inventory of timber that operators could look to, and that's gone away. And so there simply isn't the safety valve, if you would. The inventory that's available is what you see advertised for 97 and what the timber community must work on.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
If John Sturgeon would please join us.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, it's truly a welcome, or truly nice to be here. It's always nice to come to Juneau nowadays where we feel really welcome when we come down here, so it's a good group to work with. Introduce myself, I'm John Sturgeon. I'm president of Concord Forest Products. I'm also on a board of forestry, also on the executive committee of Resource Development Council. We'll be talking tomorrow, I think. And as maybe a real quick briefing of our company, Concord Forest Products. We're a company that's owned by four small native corporations, one in Southeast Alaska, one in Prince William Sound, and two in the Kodiak area. We generate about $75 million a year in revenue. We have about 2,000 shareholders, and I guess when we talk about the timber industry, one thing we forget about sometimes is that the company the money that our company has generated over the last 20 years, and this is our 20th year in business in Alaska here, goes to those villages, and they've done a lot of things to help Alaska's economy. One, for example, is a major owner of a new bank in Anchorage. Another one, two of them have built fish processing plants in their villages. There's probably several hundred young Native children that have gone on to higher education because of the funds. There's the scholarship programs. There's senior programs that our villages have set up. So we talk about the timber industry, and at least on private land, it goes far beyond just the impact of 500 or 600 people in our company. It goes to our shareholders, which use the money, and it all stays in Alaska and generates jobs. So just wanted to point that out. What I'd like to talk to you today is about the Alaska's Forest Practices Act. Alaska's Forest Practices Act was passed in, or originated in about 1989, passed in, I think, 1990, and that act applies to private land and applies to state land, borough land, mental health lands, and university lands. Doesn't affect state lands at all. As far as private landowners, that is the major law that we abide by as far as harvesting our trees, and it's one of the ones that we pay most attention to and the one we work with the most. Go back a little bit to 1989. Chairman Hudson talked about the Forest Practices Committee that was set up, a multiple agency or multiple discipline group. That group was made up of fishermen, environmentalists, loggers, sawmillers, private landowners. There was a pretty good mix. That group are the ones that came up with the original Forest Practices Act, which over the last 7 years has not changed a whole lot. They based that original Forest Practices Act on four main principles, which I'd like to remind you of today. One was that it'd be fair to all parties involved. That secondly, that there'd be no big hit for any one entity. In other words, as a private landowner, we shouldn't have to give up a dollar's worth of trees for a penny's worth of benefit, and that we would share the risk between the various resources, that the private landowners wouldn't guarantee absolutely 100% protection to all resources at the expense of the management of our private lands. So the no big hit theory was a very important factor in developing the original Forest Practices Act, and still is today. Third principle was that it was enforceable, was something that would work for the private landowners. You could really do it in the field. And last thing, that it would have professional management. Those are the four basic principles that the Forest Practices Act was based on. And what the founders of this, or the originators of this act, did, maybe to answer your question, Chairman Hudson, they set up a Board of Forestry, which was supposed to be a continuation of this group. And the Board of Forestry meets about four times a year, and it's made up of pretty much the same mix of people. And that Board of Forestry, before it can approve anything, it has to be unanimous minus one. So it really works on a consensus. And if anybody has any changes they want to the Forest Practices Act, they bring it in front of the Board of Forestry, and then the Board of Forestry mulls it over, In fact, I think this session you'll be getting some recommendations to the Board of Forestry to make some changes to the Forest Practices Act. I would hope that it'll be something easy for the legislature to do because all the major interest groups will have approved it. And the idea was to get that consensus before it comes to the House and the Senate and the bill is introduced. So hopefully it'll it's an act that's dynamic. If that's the point I want to make. Also to remind you that the Forest Practices Act was supposed to focus on three things. Supposed to try to do. Number one, it was supposed to protect fish habitat from any harm from timber harvesting. Secondly, it was supposed to protect water quality. And thirdly, it was to assure reforestation or trees would come back after you got done timber harvesting. The Act does a lot of things, but basically those are the three things that it really focuses on. And even today, those are the things that we work on the most. The question is, how well is the Act working? To quote the Board of Forestry in their last, I think their meeting last, I think it was last October or so, said the Act is working generally very well in protecting fish habitat and water quality. And I think that most people that work with the Act would tell you they agree with that. There's some other things that would point out the Act is working too. The industry has done, I think, a real good job of funding monitoring programs. In other words, we have paid private scientists to go out and set up studies that monitor water quality and the effects on fish habitat. And we have done that with the cooperation of the Department of Natural Resources, the Department of Environmental Conservation, have both been very cooperative. And to us, this is really important because what it does, it tells you whether, in fact, the Forest Practices Act is really doing what it's supposed to do, protecting water quality and protecting fish habitat. And after about 4 years of study, we're happy to report that we can find no detectable impacts from timber harvesting. We did like 2 years before, and it's been several years afterwards. And not that there isn't, but we have not been able to detect any. One of the areas we could sure use some help in this area is that the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has not participated in these monitoring studies as we'd like them to. And in order to bring credibility to these, we have to have agency support, all the agencies working with us. We realize that if we're going to spend money on monitoring, if we do it strictly ourselves and we don't have the government come in and assist us, that our studies are not going to have any credibility. So we encourage the agencies to work with us, and you asked the ways you can help us, that's a way you can help us. Other things that we have some, there's been some government studies done. In your packet you have a copy of a NOAA Coastal Ocean Program Decision Analysis Number 7 highlighted in here. And what this report did is look at the various Forest Practices Acts across the United in the Western United States. And I think some very significant things in here. I highlighted some areas for you, but I think that perhaps one of the most significant things, if you could pull out of your packet, this is the cover, and turn to what it says, page 97. And I'll show it here yet. But what I think fish biologists without question agree that one of the most important factors in protecting fish habitat is contribution of large woody debris. In other words, we want logs to go into the streams. The logs are there. We want to stay. And so when we work with state agencies, the thing that they're most concerned about is that there's a long-term supply of large woody debris, that logs will eventually fall into the streams, provide habitat. And what this study does is it analyzes how Alaska compares to the other states. And as you see on page 97, Alaska does very well as far as large woody debris contribution. So we have an act that people should be proud of. It's an act that is expensive as far as a private landowner is concerned because of the buffers that we have to leave. But we think it's working, and it is protecting fish. And you compare to a state like California, which everybody talks about having a strict environmental laws, look at California compared to Alaska private land. It's a significant difference. And what this is the source of large woody debris midway through a rotation age. In other words, the tree lives to be 100. It's like 50 years into it. And so that's, I think, a very significant fact as far as how the Act is working. And the report also speaks highly of Alaska's Forest Practices Act. So as far as how the Alaska's Forest Practices Act is doing, I think pretty well. I think, as I said, Alaska has a model act. We're very pleased with it from a private industry standpoint. And I guess I'm asking, the last thing I'll do is that I'm asked, you know, what can the legislature do, what can the government do to help the timber industry? And there's lots of things, and mine pretty much focuses on private land. One of the things that would help us is that we can assure that the enforcement or the administration of the Forest Practices Act remains consistent. That's very, very important to us. We have to have public support to be able to harvest our trees even on private land. The one way we get that public support is we have a Forest Practices Act. That sets the standard. Whether if you're on this side, you're doing a good job. If you're not, you're a bad guy. And you have to have someone saying if you're doing a good job. And that's the role of the Division of Forestry. They inspect our operations. We welcome them. And to keep those folks coming in a consistent and reliable period is very, very important to us. So making sure that the Division of Forestry can administer the Forest Practices Act is very important to us. Secondly, is that maybe assuring that the statutes and regulations that we have, maybe to Representative Masick's question, what should be changed? Sometimes it's not so much should be changed, it's just that the laws that we have and the regulations that we have are consistently enforced, and sometimes we have laws on the books, been on the books for 10 years sometimes, and all of a sudden an agency person will read those, and all of a sudden we have a new law from an existing statute or regulation that we hadn't thought about or even knew about for 10 years. And so consistent, reliable enforcement of regulations and statutes are real important. Also, if there's some way you can streamline where agencies can work together better, that is also very helpful. And that consistency is very important because when we invest in a new operation, like when we started our Montague operation, we spent $10 million before the first log went in the water, and there wasn't one penny of government money. That's all had to come out of our checking account. So the more things that we can take from being unknowns to knowns, the more predictable the agencies can be as far as their enforcement, the better off we are and the more we can invest. So consistent enforcement of existing laws is real important, number two thing. And number three thing, which I mentioned, is that to assure that all agencies, especially Alaska Department of Fish and Game, participate in monitoring studies, participate in the effects of timber harvesting on resources, so that if we're going to spend money to do monitoring, that it has credibility because the agencies have become involved. Again, the Division of Forestry, especially under Tom Bhutan, have been very helpful in assisting us in this area, as well as the Department of Environmental Conservation. And the last thing I would suggest is that maybe there's something new and radical, but that somehow in the state's decision-making process, there was something, some kind of a cost-benefit analysis for regulations or statutes or decisions the government makes. A lot of times it's a little frustrating to us that we're asked to do something and there hasn't been a lot of thought into we spend a dollar for a penny's worth of benefit. And we think that if the public is going to ask a private landowner to do something, they should go through that process of asking themselves, what is the benefit to the public and at what cost to the private landowner? And maybe something like an economic impact statement or something like that. That's all the time that I have allotted, so I'll close for there. And I'd like to thank you again for listening to us. The timber industry in Alaska is an extremely critical time. If something isn't done, we're not going to be the same industry. In fact, we're not going to have an industry if it keeps going like this. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much, Mr. Sturgeon.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Sturgeon, welcome.
Scott.
Down. Good to see you again. There was some testimony by Mr. Champion that there's always a possibility of maybe stockpiling some fiber because there's a problem what to do with the timber in the sales that isn't saw grade timber.
Right.
And I guess two questions. Number one, how long do the logs last stockpiled, and would it be better to chip them in stockpile to get more? It's obviously more expense and more exposure whether or not you're going to sell them, but do you get a longer life out of chips?
Logs, we can go sometimes 3 or 4 years, and they get a little sap rot in them. And in fact, 1995 was a very good chip market, and we had logs that were pulp logs that were decked along the road. And our logger, Silver Bay, got several more trucks that brought into our operations, took all that pulp that was alongside the road and shipped it. Some of it was 3, 4 years old, some 5. But 3 to 4 years is probably reasonable before it gets too much sap rot. And as far as chipping it, the problem with chipping, it's first of all, getting the equipment in there is expensive. You have a waste problem on private land you have to deal with. And then transporting the chips from one of our operations to a ship is a very expensive process because you have to have blowers and you know, some kind of a conveyor belt or something. So we have not found it to be very practical, and I think we're better off leaving it in the log form until the market improves, and then we can do something. The pulp mills going down is not only a national forest problem, it's a problem for private landowners, because we sold our pulp, and we're fortunate in places like Fogneck, it's only like maybe 7 or 8% of our production. But in other places like Southeast Alaska, like Earl said, it's up to 35-40% sometimes. So it's a big problem for us. Private landowners, state timber sales, and the federal folks not having a home for that low-grade log.
Is there any way to determine in advance of cutting the tree down whether or not a log is going to be pulp or saw grade?
Well, people that cruise timber, that's part of their job. But the variations on cruises they can get close, but certainly not, maybe within 10-15%. Leaving it standing a lot of times is not very practical in Alaska because you log with high lead systems and you have cables that are swinging, you have shovel logging where you have equipment moving, and we have not figured out a way to be able to leave those trees standing and still operate.
Yes, Representative
Massey. Yes, Mr. Chairman, I just want to thank him for his testimony. I have a couple of questions that I know we're running a little over time. I'll just want to let you
okay.
know I'd like to speak with you
okay.
later on.
Thank you,
it.
Representative
thank
Massey.
You.
If you could stand by for a little bit after
sure.
we're done, we're going to try to get through this
okay.
Rather broad-based presentation here. But we do appreciate you being
here. Okay, well, thank you for letting me talk, and thank you for all your support.
Terry Neninger, please. Neninger. Welcome, Terry.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Terry Neninger. I'm vice president and one of the principals of Circle DE Pacific Corporation. I'm also on the board of directors of the Alaska Forest Association. I'll try to make this short and succinct. I know we're running out of time. I wanted to just speak briefly about who we are and our presence in South Central Alaska, and then there's a couple of issues I just wanted to hit on. Circle DE Pacific is involved in the harvest of beetle-infested timber and beetle-dead timber, and we take that product and manufacture it primarily into wood chips for export to Japan. We're a radical departure from what John just talked about regarding the rest of Alaska. We run about at best 65% pulp and 35% exportable logs, and frequently in the areas we're in, they'll run 100% pulp. We operate on the Kenai Peninsula, and we harvest on lands that run primarily from Clam Gulch to Homer. We started operations in 1992, and we've built a chip storage and reload facility at Homer. This was funded by an ADA loan for about $4 million, and we have facility there that includes a 4-acre tract and then a chip loading system is similar to what John spoke about, with about a 1,700-foot conveyor system and then other modifications to the existing deepwater dock in Homer. We built a state-of-the-art facility. We studied a number of the facilities in the United States pretty closely before we designed and built ours, and we have the ability to load a full chip vessel, which is 14,000 to 15,000 bone dry units in about 3.5 days. That's as good as anyone else on either the East Coast or the West Coast, and better than a lot of other chip loading facilities. We normally have about 65 full-time employees. We have another 65 people that work for us directly but are on the payrolls of our subcontractors. Our product is harvested with feller bunchers and then skittered with rubber-tired skitters or track machines, and the product is either then chipped in the woods and the wood chips are hauled to our pad at Homer, or the logs are hauled to one of three concentrations three concentration yards we have, and where that product is ultimately chipped or segregated out for export as peeler, low-grade peeler, and saw logs. In 1996, we produced about 135,000 bone-dry units. That's about 325,000 tons of logs, or about 11,500 log truck loads. That represents around 8,500 acres of logging. And I just want to qualify, the timber lands that we have on the Kenai Peninsula average between 5,000 and 7,000 feet to the acre, as opposed to the 35,000 to 40,000 feet per acre they have in Southeast. We have a long-term purchase agreement with Mitsui Trading Company, and our timber resources come primarily from regional and village corporations We have a contract with Cook Inlet Region Incorporated for about 17,000 acres. The Nilchik Native Association, we have a contract for about 10,000 acres. And we also have a 50 million foot contract, which is about 10,000 acres, with the Crescent River Timber Venture, which basically is a JV between the Nilchik and Sildovia Native Corporations. We also have a number of smaller state sales totaling about 7,000 acres. And we have a substantial University of Alaska sale, substantial for the U of A for South Central, which is about 2,800 acres. We are actively involved in reforestation on state and university lands. Last year, we replanted about 480,000 seedlings, and that was primarily on state of Alaska lands. Our product is used for both high-grade bond letterhead. It's very light in color. It takes a nominal amount of bleaching in the pulp process, which makes it environmentally friendly. And it also is used for newsprint. In fact, it's used predominantly for newsprint. Newsprint is a high-value product, believe it or not. The spruce has a lot of fiber strength, which keeps newsprint, which is very thin, keeps it together. We're excited about our operation in the Kenai. We feel like we have a win-win operation. We generate revenues to timberland owners that have a product that's decreasing in value rapidly. We've reduced the fire threat. We create local jobs, and we also generate about $250,000 a year for the city of Homer for their deep water dock. There are a couple of things I did want to address specifically. Circle the E Pacific encourages the state to continue its timber sale program on beetle-infested and beetle-dead timber. There is a five-year program that is in place for the Kenai Peninsula, and we would like to see some of that timber consolidated into one or two single large sales, preferably one single large sale of about 80 million feet or about 16,000 acres. I'm going to see many of you individually in the next couple of days if I haven't already talked to you regarding our intentions here, but basically we feel that in consolidating what has already been laid out in the Forest Practices Act sales into one larger sale and enable some of the larger players in the Kenai to develop a longer-term market and quite possibly increase our production. The facility at Homer does 135,000 to 140,000 BDUs a year. There's no reason why it couldn't do 300,000 BDUs a year. We operate that facility about 4.5 days out of the month, and the rest of the time it sits idle. Our plan would not interfere with a small timber owner sale program. In fact, we are strong advocates of that. We've also worked closely with the Division of Forestry regarding a proposed sale, and they are proponents of what we're talking about. A second issue I want to talk about briefly is on behalf of our key resource base, which is Native Corporations, specifically Cook Inlet Region and the Nilchik. The Native Corporations are having trouble continuing to provide timber because of the requirements of the Forest Practices Act regeneration stipulations. And they are addressing this issue both with the Forest, they will address this issue with the Board of Forestry as well as a number of resource people both here in the legislature and on the administrative side. But they have some problems with both the restocking requirements, which are about 450 spruce seedlings per acre, and the seven-year window, which is allowed for these restocking requirements. Siri and Nilchik are actively involved in and coming up with a program of land utilization that best suits the needs of their shareholders. And they're looking at a combination of regeneration with other land uses. They are escrowing funds for regeneration. But at this point in time, they're running in a difficult situation as far as being able to meet the regeneration requirements and generate any kind of profit from their timber holdings. They're in a dilemma as to whether they should continue to provide timber. This ties right directly back into what John Sturgeon said about the no big hit theory, because this is a big hit. And if they should decide not to provide any more timber because of this, these state statutes and mandates, it's going to create a problem for all of us downstream that are in the timber industry. We have some concerns about this, and we will also address this with you individually. Lastly, and then I'll let you go, I just wanted to validate what John said regarding the Forest Practices Act, and I'm speaking on both principal of my company and a member of the board of directors at AFA. We're strong proponents of the Forest Practices Act regulation enforcement provisions, and we feel it's imperative that we keep these guys on board. We need to keep the DEC, the Fish and Game, and the Division of Forestry people out in the woods to see what we're doing. We feel it validates what we're doing. It also keeps some of the other players that may be on the periphery of complying with regulations in line. And it certainly justifies and speaks for the long-term program of forest health and timber management in the state. And that's all I have, unless anybody has any questions. Okay.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate that. And last but not least, Value-Added Processing in Alaska, Ketchikan Sawmill, Dan Benson, Dick Leary. I'd like everyone who has come here today to recognize that many of our members had to go on to other committee meetings, and they'll certainly enjoy, I think, the reports and the materials that you've left here.
Mr. Chairman and committee members, my name is Richard Leary, and I'm the controller of Ketchikan Pulp Company. Accompanying me today is Mr. Dan Benson, who's our production manager at Ketchikan Sawmill. We are very proud of our facilities, we're very proud of our people who make our products, and we're very proud of the product that we deliver to the market, and we really enjoy the chance to talk to you people about our sawmill operations. In brief summary, Ketchikan Pulp Company, sawlog quality logs, which constitute about 55% of our forest down there, spruce and hemlock type, are converted to either one of our two sawmills. The larger log, saw log 16 inches and up approximately, is converted at our Annette hemlock mill. The smaller saw logs, which range down to 5 inches up to 15 inches, are converted at our Ketchikan sawmill located adjacent to the Ketchikan Pulp Company. Construction on the KSM facility began in 1988, and the first logs were sawn on April 5, 1989. Total cost of the mill was approximately $15 million. The mill was constructed on 11.2 acres of land, which was already owned by KPC. With sufficient raw material, the mill can operate on a two-shift basis year-round. A two-shift operation will employ approximately 89 people. And these 89 people are just the direct sawmill jobs. They don't include the logging jobs, the towboat operators, the stevedores, or the administrative or managerial staffs. KSM processes small diameter saw logs into plain green lumber products. Our products are able to come off, hit the docks in Japan, and go right into their housing market. It is a finished product. The Annette sawmill was built in 1968 and is owned by the Metlakatla Indian community. KPC has leased this mill since 1971. With sufficient raw material, this mill can operate also on a two-shift basis year-round, and will employ approximately 100 people with, again, the same description of jobs. The mill is a cornerstone of the Metlakatla economy. While processing large diameter saw logs into high quality cant, flitch, and green lumber. I've got Dan here. He'd like to take you on a picture tour through our operations. We have to apologize. Our slideshow didn't make it up, but our handouts did.
Good afternoon. In the booklets in front of you is a picture tour through both of these sawmills. Mr. Leary has provided an overview for the Annette and Ketchikan sawmills. Allow me to take you on a tour. Log rafts arrive in the Ward Cove, and KSM lifts the individual bundles of logs to a breakdown deck. Bundles are broken apart, and each log is sent through the debarker. At this point, two things transpire. First, the flow of material diverges as the bark is collected in trucks and taken to the power boilers. That bark reduces our need for diesel in power generation, and the log is going to continue on down the line for further processing. Second, from the point that the log hits the debarker, every processing center in the complex becomes computer-assisted. We use programmable logic controllers to handle machine sequencing, timing, and conditions monitoring tasks. This allows each employee to focus more on the subjective decision-making portion of our lumber production. While the debarked logs are trimmed according to the defect content, such as knots and rot, into primarily 10 and 13 foot segments. We accumulate these in the yard for processing in the sawmill. Now these lengths work well for both the domestic and the export markets. The log merchandising line allows Ketchikan Sawmill to run a broad spectrum of logs, from pulp utility logs to the high grade, while still realizing the highest possible fiber recovery. When fed to the sawmill, each segment is swung through a two-axis infrared scanning system and is measured for length, shape, and diameter. A real-time solution generator uses this data to position the segment for maximum yield. A solution generator combines our product line with our machine capability and makes up the sawing pattern on the fly. The segment passes through a high-strain quad bandsaws where the boards and cants continue to one of our two edgers. These three breakdown centers utilize state-of-the-art technologies to produce the least possible waste. We use linear positioning setworks, which are accurate to 1/1000ths of an inch. We use thin curved saws and cobalt alloy tipping of our saws to assure a product that is of consistently high quality. The edger saws actually float on a bubble of air between the saw plate and guide surface to reduce heat buildup. Mill run lumber is stacked after being sorted, precision end trimmed, and packaged to be run in the planer department. These packages are broken down and fed through a high-speed planer that maintains product size tolerances to within 2/1000ths of an inch. The lumber is graded and sorted according to defect content, such as knots or decay, and then it's packaged and tallied and stored for shipment. We maintain a close relationship with our customers, and one of these, a result of this relationship, has come about in a mini package product that's enjoyed a wider popularity in the past few shipments. And what it is a small bundle of our lumber product that allows the Japanese carpenter to take our product from the distribution yard right to his job site and go to work with it with a minimum of effort. Further improvements we'll be looking at the Ketchikan sawmill as we move forward will be variable pitched band saws and thinner curved edger saws. Now, the Annette Hemlock sawmill's product flow is similar. However, as Mr. Leary said, the Annette mill processes the larger log from the forest. They use computerized setworks in the headrig and edger, log merchandising, and an integrated resaw facility that allows the Annette sawmill to provide a tremendous flexibility in its product line. Logs are dewatered and fed to the demerchandising line, where they are debarked and trimmed to remove all the possible defect and provide the highest value for that log. Each piece is sorted and graded, while one run actually resulted in over 45 different sorts of lumber being pulled during that one shift. That portion of lumber production that contains too much defect is routed to the resaw operation, where the lumber is resized and the defects are removed. The resaw operation has added the capability to extract high-value items from low-return products and even scrap. Also, here in this mill, all the lumber is tallied according to size and grade and stored for next shipment. Both of these mills aggressively seek improvements in our processes to ensure the highest possible fiber recovery from each log. We continuously review all of our operations to add the highest value to every log we run. We have an international reputation of quality and have the people, technology, and facilities to thrive in both the domestic and export markets. The critical question for us is, do we have the resource supply necessary to continue our operations? With this kind of background, Mr. Leary can discuss our product line.
We brought a few of the domestic byproducts that come from our production. We'd like to share them with you. Both of our sawmills target their primary production towards the traditional housing market in Japan. Approximately 80 to 85% of the AHM production and 55% of the export production from KSM is aimed towards this traditional market. KSM delivers finished products, which are used for structural components in the housing market. HM products are remanufactured into specialty door and window frames. High-grade spruce is used in precision musical instruments as well. Stud logs or lower-grade saw logs at Ketchikan Sawmill can be merchandised and in the higher segments turned into export quality lumber, with the lower ones available for what is known as stud rough lumber, or can be converted into chips depending upon the various returns in place of time. The lower grade cans and cut stock grades from each mill enter the domestic market in the Pacific Northwest. And this volume ends up in what you're looking at here. The future. If I could direct you to the one handout, which is the aerial view of the site, I'd just like to discuss the options available to us in the future. The infrastructure currently at the Ward Cove site can be used for many further value-added production, as well as other industrial opportunities. We have hired a real estate development expert to help us in this area of conversion. The map, the picture that you have in front of you, we're trying to express how we see our vision of what these facilities will look like after cleanup, and the colored legend tells you that. But we think there is genuine opportunity to peel logs for veneer. We're seriously looking at drying our production. And the darker blue area, our wood room facilities are very strategically located to whole log chip the lower grade logs. It has the infrastructure to produce the volume needed to fill the larger export ships. The power facilities are also right there. The covered warehousing space, the water supply. With the impending closure of the pulp mill, KPC is entering a new phase. The challenges ahead are many, but they can be overcome. Although we are saddened by the loss of our pulp mill and the effect it had on our community, we are optimistic and upbeat about our future. Ketchikan Pulp is also extremely grateful for the support we have received from this body and hope this spirit can help bring stability to our industry. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Very informative. I know it's for a short period of time. We wanted to try to provide as many of the committee members as could be here for some time with an overview from different parts of the state of Alaska with the industry. What I heard today is that supply appears to be one of the major issues and elements, no matter where you're looking at it or what product you're looking for.
Absolutely correct.
Yes. Representative Massey. Co-chair.
Do you make the finger joint material there? Do you have a finger joint?
No, we make the raw material. We do not do the finger joining at our operations.
Do you do any kiln drying?
No, we have looked at it, but we do not do kiln drying.
Perhaps Representative Williams, do you have a question? Maybe you'll answer my question with your question. Did you have a question?
Oh, I'm sorry. You mentioned that, thank you, Mr. Chairman. You mentioned that you could get two shifts at the sawmill, but you didn't say how much wood that it could take. And are you talking about both sawmills? And what are you going to do with the pulp?
We would,
after the mill closes.
Representative, we would love to be able to run both our sawmills for two shifts. Our product is accepted. We haven't had what we call inventory shutdowns by not being able to move our product. Roughly, it takes 100,000 board feet per single shift. So four shifts would require 400,000. We'd like to run them 50 weeks. Provides continuous employment. We can make and deliver a product that's wanted.
So you're talking about